My name is Don DeBar, and I am a journalist in the U.S., New York area particularly. Today I'm in Buffalo, New York, which is northwestern part of New York State in the northeastern United States on Lake Erie, very near the Canadian border. And I'm on vacation with my girlfriend and another couple of friends. I've been a journalist for 25 years. It's always been an avocation until I retired from my career in the business world in 2011. I've been doing news at radio stations in particular since I'd say 2008 or 2009. I started at WBAI with Pacifica Radio and have been working with various Pacifica radio stations and others for the period since. I also do political commentary. Frequently I'm on Press TV, I've been also on a lot RT, some on CGTN and Telesur and some others.
Okay, Don. So your take, please, on the big news, really, I suppose, from a global point of view, is that Trump has now seems to have fallen out with Putin. He was kind of in love with him quite, you know, I really think this guy's a good guy. He wants peace, blah, blah. Everything seems to have changed over the last week or so.
Okay, well, the information that we get, of course, comes through the media. It's mediated, literally. This is the same media that has, in essence, treated Trump as an invader or usurper or clearly, in terms of geostrategy, an enemy. Whether it's Trump or the group around Trump, whoever the real power behind that is, because this is a guy, of course, whose primary business was just leasing his name to other builders of large projects. And so he may well be just like other American politicians, the face before the actual holders of the throne.
But hang on, because isn't surely the situation with politics in so much of Europe and America there is such a mess that by the mainstream press having a go at someone, it's almost like an endorsement.
That's correct. And that actually is kind of what got him elected both times. Where I am in Buffalo, for example, I drove from Westchester County, which is in New York City suburbs, which is relatively affluent, I'd say even on a global scale. Upstate New York, like 150 miles north of where I live, and for another 150 miles, is not quite so affluent. And that condition has existed for decades now. It's like the rest of what they call the Rust Belt, where there used to be manufacturing and mining and similar jobs and heavy duty, union jobs that have gone away, since the mid 60s forward. The debris, of that is in terms of the economy, in terms of the political economy remains here. And Trump is very popular with the people who've suffered that situation over the last decades. I was at the first nominating convention in 2016. Cleveland, which is a perfect example of that. So, you know, when the press beats up on him, there's a built-in constituency in the United States who's also highly motivated that supports him. There's also the political partisan aspect to it. Democrats and Republicans, like two adjoining towns that are almost identical in every way, except one is north and one is south, and they have two different football teams, they become the strongest rivals. There's all kinds of psychology on, work on this, that the more identical human beings are, the more significant they find the slight differences, and the slightest difference can make mortal enemies out of someone. This phenomenon is pretty much what we see between Republican and Democratic partisans among the population. And because Trump is a Republican on the ballot and has been espousing to pitch to a segment of the standard Republican voters and elite Republicanist ideas to the extent there could be such a thing, the Democrats automatically hate him. And rather than looking at their own Democratic politicians for the faults that we find with what's going on, such as wars all over the place, continued institutional racism, and all these other problems, instead, it's Trump's fault, that slavery was his fault, extermination of the indigenous people here was his fault, that Eve was in a bad mood one day was his fault. And you see evidence of this in the media all the time. They dig up the guy that sat behind him in kindergarten class and said he passed wind in class, you know, or whatever. It's both got its entertainment value, and it operates to polarize people who might otherwise get actually involved in politics. So this whole morass goes on. He gets elected, and the real fear from what we can glean, to the extent that can be done from, you know, the media and elsewhere, is the fear of the, of the establishment, quote unquote, or what they call the deep state or whatever, that he somehow is going to be an instrument of making peace, not having a war with Russia, perhaps also solving the problem of genocide in Israel, or stopping it or mitigating it or something. And that certain large sea changes are going to take place that the elite is hell-bent on seeing won't happen. This is kind of, you know, the sort of the play that's been, you know, written and rehearsed and formulated is being presented now on the world stage. There have been repeated attempts going back to when he was running in 2015 to find a watershed moment where some betrayal of the promises to his supporters or some other, you know, obstacle has people abandoning him now, and we're going to start seeing the, you know, the MAGA people, even before they were MAGA people, walking away and turning their backs on him. So that was, and so now he's talking tough and not making peace in Ukraine, and he's angry at Putin. Or he had promised that the whole constituency of people who had Epstein's list, et cetera, as a major international political issue, that he betrayed them, and now they're abandoning him. And one after another, we see these different things happen, and then somebody takes a poll and find out not a single one of these people gives a damn about any of that crap, because their condition is exactly the same. The roads I came up here, the houses I drove past that haven't been painted in 15 years, have a rusted car in the driveway, kids, you know, that need, you know, money, basically, all deprived for decades. Every time a new one of these things passes through the media, not a damn thing changes for them. And he is still the only person that's even said, I'm going to do something for you. Even as they see that it hasn't happened yet, and maybe it's never going to happen, there's nobody for them to go to promising them anything. And so I don't know how this turns out yet, but the objective conditions created Trump and or Trumpism, whatever they are. And nothing has happened yet that's going to resolve that, other than we're going to find something even more like that and worse.
Well, look, given that Trump is fallen out of love with Putin, now talking about having threatened to bomb Moscow in his first term, this is just, this is the art of the deal. This is the sort of threat that you say you want to make. But then, have you fallen out of love with Trump? Because you were quite, I wouldn't necessarily say a dyed-in-the-wool supporter, no, right? No. But you were saying that there was some hope with this guy. It does look rather quickly as if that's all, you know, we haven't even talked about Iran yet, but it's all falling to pieces, Don.
My hope, quote-unquote, you know, the last time we spoke, was that if Trump were elected, we wouldn't go right to war with Russia like, you know, full guns. And so far, that's true. I've heard what he said. I've been following what they're saying around that war and around the military stuff in general very closely. I also saw what Peskov said yesterday or the day before, which is, we hear all that. Yeah, we also pay attention to what's being done. So, you have cool heads in the Kremlin in Moscow. They are equipped to protect themselves, and they realize that people will try to play that against them. We're going to catch you with your guard down. Oh, yeah, you do have those hypersonic missiles, but you didn't know we had this thing that could turn off everything that, any kind of explosion coming out of Russia or make it blow up on the way. They know that there might be a surprise working, and I think they have a very good sense of how much they can allow to happen. What I saw that troubled me, and maybe my foot was on the accelerator a little more on my way towards the Canadian border yesterday, was when they started talking about not Trump, but somebody in Kiev talking about that they were going to send, an armada against Moscow, that there was going to be some kind of a big hit, and that came out the same day that Trump was talking about rearming them. And I thought to myself, if there is a massive attempt, or even another attempt, I think, to hit Moscow, I think that the necessary counter move isn't going to just be to, bomb the hell out of Kiev, but they're going to have to blow something up either in Europe or here.
And, maybe. I don't know if you've picked this up, but we had a blip on the BBC Today programme this morning here in the UK. Defence Secretary John Healey says Britain is ready to send troops to Ukraine to help end or continue, depending, you cross out whichever one you want, war with Russia. An update on plans for a coalition of the willing, which actually does look as if it's going to be just Zelensky and Starmer as much of a coalition. But so the Brits are saying this too. There's been quite a lot of publicity here about the recent overnight attacks by the Russians on Kiev. Two people killed last night. Actually, there was no mention of the scores of people killed in Palestine, actually, on the news, funnily enough.
Yeah,
what do you make? I mean, do you think that the Americans are now that whole Oval Office meeting is over with, out the window, and the Americans are kind of back on board with this, what seems now to be just really a European and mainly British plan to have a war with Russia?
I think that Russia's, I'm a military strategist, and as a matter of fact, I never did a day in military service, and I wouldn't, as long as I can get away with it. But I believe, looking at the sending of British troops, an actual, formal movement of troops to Ukraine by Britain, that the counter move would be to allow them to land and then blow them up. When their feet hit the Kiev soil, or wherever, in Lvov or wherever else, the minute they land, that they get vaporized, and saying, okay, we're not blowing up England yet. That's next. If you send two to try to overwhelm us, we're going to blow them up where they take off. But that seems like a scaled counter move, something on that order. I think we might have seen some of that. First of all, I remember hearing rumors that the early part of this, the operation, the latest phase of it since February of 2023, that there was an attack, and I think it was near Lvov, that ended up being a NATO headquarters or something, and that there were a bunch of upper level NATO geniuses underground that got wiped out. I had heard that as a rumor. And I had heard a couple of things here that made me think it was true. I don't know if it has been or not, but I do know that there have been a number of incidents where they, training camps and such, where Americans and Brits, were taken out. And I don't know exactly why that wasn't a rallying point, except that I think there are some cooler heads that don't want a wild. First of all, I think an honest assessment of the population in the United States I think even one with wishful thinking to the contrary that has at least one foot in the world of reality would recognize that the American people do not support in any way the idea of going to war against Russia. No, we remember, those of us that are old enough, the early 19th, like I remember myself, personal experience with my head against the floor in the hallway of my school, waiting, they're telling us to keep our eyes closed until after we hear the blast, because the flash will blind us, and peeking to see if the flash came yet. You know, for a week and a half we did that in October of 1962, and it wasn't the first time we had done it. And that suddenly we were relieved from that, supposedly, in 1990, 91, even in the late 80s. And that had happened twice also, being relieved of a detente and all of that. And then they started that crap up all over again in the late 70s with Brzezinski. I can't imagine a scenario, including a World Trade Center scenario or some other, whatever they called it, Pearl Harbor type stimulus that would catalyze the American people into a frenzy that would have them calling for World War III. I just don't think there's anybody in this country, obvious evidence to the contrary notwithstanding, that are that friggin' stupid. And so that kind of curtails their ability to move into that war a lot. I mean, they can't do it. You need the conventional tools. It doesn't foreclose them from doing it. Maybe it does, but it certainly is an impediment.
Yeah, okay. But, I mean, a child can see the situation over in Ukraine. You just draw a line between the Russian-speaking area, the Ukrainian-speaking area, you have an armistice, and you all go home. But this, apparently, Putin doesn't want. I think more people were hoping and expecting Putin to agree to something like that.
Well, he wants more than that, and he should. He doesn't want NATO installing military assets in the remainder of Ukraine, that real estate. You know, look, like I said, I'm a military strategist. I don't know anything, say, about air currents for bombers and fighter jets and God knows what the hell else. How you stage supply lines to the naval fleet in the Black Sea and such. He has a pretty clear idea of that stuff, I'm sure. And so when you're talking about what real estate will I tolerate the enemy on, I mean, it's not just because of the proximity, okay? They've got it in Poland, they've got it in the Baltics, they've got it, you know, in the Arctic, they've got it in the Korean Peninsula, Okinawa, wherever the hell, Diego, you know, everywhere. But their last stand is on that piece of real estate. I assume that there's some military strategic reason for that. And that so, I, you know, if that's true, then you say, look, I know we're going to have the war. I'm not going to lose it because of this. If we're gonna
yeah, well, that's right. Starmer has been talking about with Zelensky about these, what they call security guarantees. They say, well, we will only have this ceasefire if NATO troops are allowed to be stationed here. We've got guarantees, blah, blah, blah. Seems to me the only guarantees that are really necessary are on the other side, that, you know, Zelensky, for example, is going to work to stop the war, which he's elected to do in the term, you know, he's no longer president. His presidential terms run out quite a long time ago. So any thoughts about why there is no, it seems from the West, actually, impetus to stop this?
Well, because they think they can take Russia down. Look, the goal is regime change in Russia. And they're tightening the screws, whether it's, I don't know what game Trump is playing. It may well be Trump was elected to do exactly what's going to come next in that war. It may well be that. And it may well be that that's true even if it wasn't what he intended or the people around him intended, because that's what they're presented with now in choice. Look, let's go back just for an example to 2017. He took office January 20th, okay? So, it was in May or June. Now, first of all, massive assault from day one about the inauguration, all, everything, every time he took a breath. the whole newspapers had him. He's dying. He's crazy. His wife is cheating on him. Everything they could do. A constant barrage of that. And then, and we're watching the polls, and the polls aren't moving at all. And then they decide, he moves in, he starts making peace, and threatens to actually sign a peace treaty. It's, you know, about 60 years late at that point, with North Korea, with DPRK, and ending the Korean War, the formal state of war. And they go, and all of a sudden, the people that were hearing him talk about Iran are listening now with the ear of someone that heard him talking about Kim Jong-il. Kim Jong-un, a year earlier, that he's now got his arm around saying, gee, you know, maybe this is his game, his art of the deal game. You talk about all this kind of stuff. What he's doing is setting up an only Nixon can go to China scenario, where he's the most outspoken opponent of this or that dictator, quote unquote. And so he's the only one we can trust to make peace. So when he goes to make peace with them, we can feel relaxed, and it's the end of the whole, you know, paradigm of war making, propaganda, and all of that stuff. It's all been settled and satisfied. So that scenario was being set up, and it was clear of the situation with Ukraine. That you know, we had the Maidan was 2013, 2014. Okay, Trump is running in 2015, talking about NATO was obsolete, and he gets elected in 2016. So the project in 2017 with Trump in the White House looks a little shaky, and he's talking about going to sit down and work things out with Putin. So the Congress decides on its own initiative, quote unquote, meaning somebody's boss called them and said, pass this legislation, and they pass a piece of legislation that removes the ability of the president to shut off any of the sanctions or stop enforcing them or whatever, and adds more sanctions to Korea, Iran, and Russia. And they run it through both houses, and it's almost unanimous. Out of 535 members, it was like 509. With, I think, three votes or five votes against and a couple of abstentions. And so his choice at that point was to either sign it and own it and try to work from that position, or to fight a losing battle, because if he vetoed it, it would be passed anyway, because you only need 3/4 and they had 96%. So I don't know if we're looking at that. And we saw what happened after that. He went over, he met with Putin, and they did some things, not a lot, because he couldn't get anything past the Congress. I mean, I don't know because, but by the way, he couldn't get anything past the Congress if he did try to do anything. But we did not go in deeper. And then Biden got elected, and it started right away, all over again. The sanctions were cranking up. They started moving missiles here and hardware there, and Russia, looking at this, has to say, they're coming in. They're coming in. So they did what they did in 2023, finally. After trying in December of 2022, maybe I have the year off, saying, look, this is all we want. Do you guys want Kiev and a bunch of lunatics over there? Fine. We don't want any NATO there. And we don't want them to be part of any war making that you guys do. If you do that, and if you leave our people alone over here, we're cool. And they didn't want that. There's this belief that they can recreate December 31st, 1991. And that they can't do that, for the same reason that I don't think, despite their best wishes, that they could convince, they could build up a war frenzy for World War III in the United States. The people of Russia remember the 1990s, the aftermath of the last time they let Washington and London and Paris, Rome, and wherever the hell else their messages were coming from, tell them to abandon their own state and their own government in favor of the better quality of stuff that was going to come from the West. They ended up starving to death, watching each other drink themselves to death, become pauperized, and they're not going to fall for it again. And so Putin's biggest risk is from people thinking that he's going to hand the country over to these thieves rather than him moving, you know, even if it's aggressively, to protect his country. And they're mistaken. The impetus behind the West right now is the mistaken belief that they're going to be able to split the people of Russia from the government and or buy off someone or some ones in the government to do like they did with Assad or whatever, and do regime change there.
Well, I think you're right. It probably Russia is a bit of a tougher nut to crack than Syria. Anyway, the Bilderberg conference, which happened back at, last month in Stockholm, the first night of the conference, we had the Israeli strike on Iran. In the weekend after that, we even had Donald Trump and his B-1 bombers. But there was, hitting Iran again, a lot of frenzy at the UN Security Council, but nothing is really much happening. And also, there's a lot of questions about this whole thing as to whether it looks quite likely that the Iranians were given ample warning to move their enriched uranium out of these sites before the hit. Also, quite clearly, when the Iranians hit back at the US air base, they were also given a warning. There's a sort of element of theatrical. You know what actually convinced me about this, Don, is that I didn't see more than a couple of 0.1 pence change on the fuel at the petrol stations here.
That's right.
It did seem a little bit stage managed, but actually very serious to have a strategic attack like that from the United States. And then, of course, there was the way that Donald Trump's attack helped to sort of Netanyahu to save face, because he wasn't doing very well in that exchange. So anyway, I wonder if you can give us your take on what happened there.
I see the same things that you're talking about. And you know, that's why I started with, you know, all we know is the virtual, you know, what we see. And because everything we see is strained through the media and what is mediated, literally. And so, it's some excellent choreography, I have to say. I don't know who the choreographer is. And what the final, final act looks like, but whatever the analog is in dance, final movement, I don't know. But it sure does look like the sensibilities of all of the players were taken into consideration. Like somebody had painted themselves into a corner, and where everyone else thought that was to their advantage, realized somehow that the game is over if that happens. Let's help them out, you know, and with some grace, and you know, and everybody keep their composure. Going into Ukraine, it's clear that the purpose of the Maidan was to secure Ukraine as a member of NATO, and that the purpose of that. And of what followed with the sanctions and everything else was to try to recreate the situation that took place in 1991. Most people aren't aware of what really happened. But what happened, this is almost a replay in terms of the strategy and tactics that if you recall détente under Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger accomplished two major strategic objectives of the United States. One was to separate formally even, the Soviet Union and China, from any kind of, military alliance, against the United States and NATO or against the United States. Where they got into like three-part game. It began, commercial exchange, between the Soviet bloc, which had been under sanctions, but frozen out basically of the Western economy almost since the revolution, brought them in, allowing access for media, also investing money to allow the basically dumping of Western goods, which were sold almost with like a cultural it's hard to explain what I saw when I was in the Soviet Union in 1990 at the sort of the end of this. But, you know, that the stuff that was in the media here was kind of true, even though it was really being broadcast for the benefit of people in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, which was that there was this demand for, like, American jeans and rock and roll, you know, and this whole youth culture that was sort of like a Trojan horse for American financial interests that, because of the structure of the Soviet economy, and because that the Western economy did not take their currency, you had like a parallel set of retail outlets there that would only take Western currency, and that sold these Western products that were then being propagandized to the mostly young people in the Soviet Union as being desirable. Walkman, short ass jeans, blah, 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 blah. Well, what happened was, because everybody thought that this was, they were peace building, the Westerners loaned Western capital to the Eastern governments, which then distributed it in various ways to people so they could buy this stuff. And they sort of dug themselves in deeper and deeper over the course of the 90s, and then they cut off the money. And you still had a demand for these products, and now the government wasn't doing it. The government became the culprit. And at the same time that was happening, that sort of opened up a huge black market in the products and goods that were being produced in the Soviet Union, where people would say the guy driving lettuce in a truck from the farm to the market in the city, would the lettuce would fall off the truck somewhere, he'd get like $50, and he'd go buy his kids some Jordache jeans in a Berioska store. Like the inside of the Soviet economy got eaten out with a black market under these kinds of conditions, at the same time that there was a political, like, disillusionment with the government and the society that was really centered around a whole chunk of the economy that had been growing based on borrowed money, and they cut the money off. So they thought they could do that again. We've had this period of, you know, engagement with Russia, that, you know, it began, you know, around 91, 93, 95, certainly since 2000. And, you know, a lot of people inside Russia are making money off of that. I have some friends that have been, since the 80s or late 80s, early 90s, have been trading in, wood products from Siberia. Like that, they were sending stuff here to be milled in Oregon and Washington. They used to be, you know, providers of wood products for the United States. It was cheaper because of the regulations to like clear cut big chunks of Siberia and ship the wood over there for them to work in the mills than it was to try to navigate getting permits and whatnot in Washington or Oregon for a few years. These kinds of parasitic relationships existed. It's part of what stripped a lot of the wealth out of Russia in the 90s. And this is all very convoluted, I know. But what I'm trying to say is that there's a belief here that if they just push hard enough, they're going to be able to do it again. And Trump started talking about with the whole thing with BRICS. You know, dumping huge tariffs on all the BRICS members, and particularly about those that buy Russian oil and gas, sounds like they're making another push. And whether Trump is going along willingly or even as the architect of it, or if this is something that's intended to drag him along like the sanctions bills did, I don't know, and I don't know that it matters much. This is the dangerous activity that's going on right now. And we have to figure out how to deal with it. And then the question is, do we deal with it by cutting Trump loose, to the extent he's not? And what happens if we do that? And what do we have if we have him and then don't have him What do we have lined up next? I mean, it's pretty tricky.
Nothing is lined up. Nothing is. They make sure there's no one lined up. And that anyone that might be lined up is either character assassinated or worse. But look back to Netanyahu and the fun and games, down the food fun and games, the idea that, this US, and Israeli company, oh God, I mean, what they're doing is effectively shooting people as they try and come and get food. Yeah. In fact, we've had a couple of whistleblowers over the last few weeks from the Israeli army, a few of them saying, look, this is disgusting. I'm no longer doing it. This is what they're up to. And in fact, I called a quick report on the World Service about a week ago where they were saying that in Palestine, nobody is told anything about these food places. They're just hungry. And obviously they go there. They hear rumors that there's food there. All of the attention of the people running this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, supposed, is on the Western press, and it seems to be almost made for them. The only dealings that the Palestinians much have is they get a few bags of rice occasionally, or they get shot in the head.
Well, look, first of all, anybody that's involved in the U.S. government or the Israeli government that has anything to say about any of this could shut their mouths, unload the bombs from all of the planes that fly over these camps, fill them with food with little parachutes, and drop the damn food on people. They'll find it. And stay the hell out of there and let them eat. But that's, and believe me, that is totally inadequate to the situation, by the way. But they're not even doing that. They're using the food as if it were bait for vermin or something, so that when it comes, they can spring the trap and kill it. That tells you everything about the nature of the people that are making this policy, here and there.
Okay, so also we've had a few developments with the Jeffrey Epstein case. If I can remember, the journalist Richie Allen here, on his show, when he was arrested, saying almost, I think it was on the same day that Epstein was arrested, everyone was quite surprised that had happened, saying, well, he will obviously be suicided. And of course, there's lots of suspicion that's exactly what happened, that Jeffrey Epstein, we got Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, Robert Maxwell, was most definitely confirmed as a Mossad agent here in London, the proprietor of the newspaper, the Daily Mirror. And he disappeared himself in mysterious circumstances. He broke the story. Actually, no, I don't think it was him, was it? It was Murdoch broke the story about Mordecai Vanunu in London being kidnapped by the Mossad, who had blown the lid off the Israeli nuclear weapons program. But anyway, look, back to Epstein. We've heard a few things the last week or so. One is that disappearing sections of the CCTV in his cell, which I would imagine would show him committing suicide or something else may be happening there. But also, Donald Trump was questioned about him this week, Don, and was very, very keen to dismiss the questions. So Trump also, in the run-up to the presidential election last year, he was questioned about releasing the JFK files, this sort of thing, which apparently he's done, some of anyway. When he was questioned about at the Epstein files, he was a little bit nervous about that. So anyway, why is it that Donald Trump doesn't seem quite confident in dealing with these Epstein and tapes? And what about the links to Israel, Mossad, that sort of thing?
Well, okay. I mean, so much of it is speculation because the list. who's got the list? With Trump, first of all, you know, when he's running for office the first time and the second time, the arithmetic for winning a presidential election in the United States is more than Byzantine, okay? You have 50 states, and each one of them is going to elect a group of people to go to the Electoral College and vote, or to send their vote to the Electoral College for president. People in the United States don't vote for the president. They vote for a slate of people who are going to vote for president, and state by state. And in some states, they're winner take all. If Bush beats, Obama by one vote in one in a particular state that has 13 of these votes. Bush gets all 13 of them. In another state, if Obama beats Bush by one vote, and there's 12 of them, then or 13 of them, then Obama will get 7, and Bush will get 6. They do proportional splits on these. So when you're concocting a strategy for a presidential campaign, you're not trying to win a majority of voters nationally on issues, but rather piecing together this cloth over the, you know, over the face of the entire country, made up of, say, Cubans in Miami, say, Haitians in St. Petersburg, Florida. So you have Cubans that are the right-wing, you know, the escapees of the revolution in 1960, their children and grandchildren living in Miami. They're very right-wing politically. And you have people that escaped the right-wing dictators in Haiti, living on the other side of Florida, and they're much more progressive, and et cetera, et cetera. Trump wins both of them in the 2016 and 2024 election, I think also in the 2020, by pitching to each of them, like microcasting message. My point being, it's not like one broad, you know, package of messages that you present to an entire electorate, but rather a bunch of little piecemeal activities, you know, where that's how you get, become elected president. So when you're looking at things that you're going to say you're going to do and not do as president, when you have groups that are interested in what some consider marginal or even fringe issues, which some people consider Epstein's book and all that to be, some consider fracking, some consider, you know, the COVID, whatever it is, you're looking at this map and where the people fall on this or that thing, and you're trying to piece together that magic number of votes of these, you know, intermediaries to become elected president. And so he said lots of things to lots of people that sounded like, that basically people who were interested in finding out what exactly the hell Epstein was up to with Mossad, CIA, and whoever the hell else, that he was going to be looking into it. And the fact that it seemed that the CIA and FBI and everybody else were, you know, after Trump, that they were vehemently opposed to and framing him and everything else, made it believable. And so people, a lot of people felt, once Trump gets in, we're finally going to get to the bottom of this. And now it seems like that's not true. So the question is, why? I don't know the answer to that yet. None of us do. But it may be, first of all, that the bottom of this is either not within his reach, or the bottom of this is going to result in triggering some reaction from some part of the government that he does not want to trigger, either ever or at this moment, you know, in terms of, you know, tactical thinking and, you know, an overall strategy. I don't know what it is. I do know a few things about it, though, and I know that, in my opinion, I mean, I don't know this, but I know enough facts to draw this as a conclusion, that he was murdered in that jail cell. I think I know who did it. I think Nicholas Tartaglione, who was a police officer in Briarcliff Manor, who was convicted of murdering four men in a cocaine deal gone bad, and then burying their bodies on some land he had in upstate New York, in Delaware County, that he was a cellmate of Epstein shortly before Epstein died, that while they were cellmates, apparently something happened where Epstein was injured in a way that some say is consistent with a suicide attempt, some others say with a murder attempt, and was hospitalized, and that at the time that Epstein died in 2019, that this guy, who had, according to the law, committed the murders in 2016, and who was looking at possibly being executed for the four murders, ended up being 5 years sitting in jail without any conclusion. He was convicted at the time, before Epstein died. It was a matter of awaiting sentencing. Will he be given the death penalty or not? And 5 years and after Epstein's death, we find out he's not going to be executed. He's going to have life in prison and probably crack it getting out at some point.
So, well, hang on, because that is, I mean, what is the death penalty for? If you've got a multiple murderer, police multiple murderer, totally abusing their position with public trust, what is the death penalty actually for?
I assume it's for people who were intending to commit some kind of revolutionary act, okay? It's something that actually strikes at the power structure. I think they have that on the books for that. But what they did do, of course, is whip up public support for it by holding out victims, you know, like working class victims of, you know, psycho murderers that, you know, made people say, look, eye for an eye, okay? This was horrible what this guy did. And, but so, meanwhile, I don't know how much more horrible it gets. I agree with you. He's a police officer. He's involved in a drug deal, a $250,000 cocaine deal, his money, trying to spin it for money. Somebody apparently hustled him out of the money, or he believed that they did. And so he baited them, got them to come to a place, his brother's bar, with two other ex-cops as bouncers, grabbed them, kidnapped them, tortured the one guy to death, and then killed the other three because they were witnesses. Shot him, executed back to the head. I don't know. If I was going to give the death penalty to someone and I wanted to make a point, that would seem like a pretty damn good case. Because it cuts across the board. People can't say, looking at that case, this is intended for black people, or this is intended for poor people, or this is intended as a weapon in the arsenal of the police against the people. This would, even if that's what it's intended for, this case would make the case that it's not. And yet, what happened was, Epstein ended up dead, and this guy didn't get the death penalty. So I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think people can draw their own conclusions, can't they? Quite happily from something like that. But look, what about, I mean, Epstein dead, Ghislaine Maxwell apparently in prison, although communicating with the outside world quite happily, apparently. And the tapes, the hard drive being maybe sitting there in Tel Aviv. I wonder, could Donald Trump be on there somewhere?
Who knows? You know, look. All right, so, I mean, I know Cynthia McKinney well, and I know Dennis Kucinich to say hello to and stuff, and I know both of them and the positions they took with respect to Middle East policy, with respect to wars in Iraq and potential war with Iran and all the other stuff that goes around it, and particularly with Israel and with AIPAC and the like. You know, I see what happened to Cynthia. She got driven out, and with Pelosi leading the charge, basically, out of the Congress. Kucinich got districted out by Democrats, in essence, using Republicans in the state legislature in Ohio as, you know, as the face of it. So this entirely because Cynthia threw them out when AIPAC came to her with something they wanted her to sign that said that, you know, she was going to support Israel and anything that happened in the Congress. You know, if an elected legislator has the ability to bind their legislative activity in writing to a third party, I don't understand where that authority comes from. And the fact that they would do it to a foreign country seems like per se treason to me. But the fact that you can do it at all is frightening because certainly if you can do it because AIPAC is happy, then you can do it because this guy wrote you a check for $22 million or whatever. If you can buy my vote, then it's just a matter of setting a price.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we also had here, by the way, a recent film interview with Jeremy Corbyn, where he was given the same sort of ultimatum, not this time by AIPAC or the, you know, Labour Friends of Israel, but by his own party executive, said to him, we can only endorse what you're, you know, we want guarantees that every foreign policy decision made by Israel, military decisions made by Israel, you will endorse them all. And he refused to do that. We also had, I think it was probably 10, 12 years ago, on the Kaiser report on RT, I can remember distinctly seeing smiling as he explained that when he did his bit of work for the BBC, the only thing they said to him is that you must never criticize Israel. And if you will get the contract, you will get the job if you don't. What is it about Israel, do you think, that is so megally powerful in the Anglo-Zionist Empire? It seems that nobody's allowed to get anywhere, whether it's in broadcasting, universities, journalism. We've just had David Miller a couple of years ago sacked. He's still involved in the court cases. A sociology professor here at Bristol University. Anywhere, no elite institution, it seems, is allowed to entertain any discussion which might be negative about Israel. And now, of course, they're involved in a genocide. So what is going on?
Well, to really explain it accurately and clearly, you have to identify what the actual locus of power is where this decision is made that these conditions will prevail. Someone's is in a position to do this. I mean, we can do, you know, deduction to, you know, looking at what is, for example, you look at the Middle East, it's, you know, a very important part of the global economy that somebody owns. I don't have a very big piece of it. It requires, you know, fuel to run on, oil, gas, et cetera. Also, transport through that region. And it is, you know, been colonized since the 19th century, really, by European and the U.S. Countries for the benefit of their economies and really for the benefit of the people who own their economies. Implanting a European settler state on the land of Palestine, which is what Zionism essentially was created to do, certainly was weaponized to do, that is kind of the gatekeeping apparatus for control of that region and management of it within the larger, you know, global economic construct. So whoever it is that is, you know, making the major benefit is also clearly the people, whoever's in control of the U.S. government, including the regulatory authorities for the public media here, by the way, and those that own and or manage things that service this economy as key infrastructure, like communications, like propaganda, like also legislation and other things. I don't know who the people are. I know the faces that are shown. I know we see AIPAC, for example, and Israeli government officials as the face of it. I know that we have a series of people in the Congress that are the one, you can see them on C-SPAN every day, one way or another, that will kiss the behind of whatever Israeli and or Arab official that services the, you know, Western dominance of that region, you know, to have their behinds kissed left, right, and sideways on television by these same people. Criticizing Israel means discussing what it actually is and what it actually does, whatever it is. What it actually is a colony, a Western, a European, American colony on the land of Palestine that has been engaged in a genocide of the people of that area since its inception in the late 19th century, and it's been an accelerated rate in our lifetime. In the last 3 years, yet another step forward in that. You look around the region in the Middle East, a lot of the so-called independent Arab states are the same. The ones that have had a modus vivendi with this colony in their neighborhood clearly are places whose governments are occupied by the same colonists. And so there's an awful lot that has to be done there to solve this problem. But our problem here is that our government is overtly now, I mean, look, the United States has had no problem whatsoever acting as a genocider from its inception, and even as it tried to behave politely, pretend to behave politely as a world actor. We can look back through Vietnam and Korea and, you know, all the way back to, you know, the first slaughter of indigenous peoples here back in the 17th century or 16th century. But we're at a point now where the whole order that's been constructed, you know, it seems that we're at the end of the colonial period. I mean, it seems like that in fits and starts even towards the end of the 19th century. But we're seeing rising now an alternative that is not based on any ideology other than, no, we're not going to be, you know, colonized by you. And so it appears to have staying power, and it appears also that it's happening as this model is collapsing of its own weight. So the ability to absorb challenges to its behavior in essential places like the Middle East, it's kind of shaky at this point. They can't tolerate it. Anyone looking at what's happening right now will recognize that we are overtly involved in a genocide of a people for no damned reason whatsoever pertaining to our security or even our well-being. And it exposes the nature of the society to understand that we're doing it anyway. Then why are we doing it? Because we're letting them do it, and they're doing it because they're greedy, power-hungry animals. You know, that is something that cuts across. You don't have to be involved in the center of power, one of the few people that have levers of power, to find affinity with the position that what's developing out there is a threat to my power, too. I might just be a member of Congress or whatever, but I better make sure that that doesn't develop because that threatens me. Like, they're consolidating, and, you know, they're really under pressure, and we need to push it. And we're not doing anything. We're standing here watching it. We're not even primary. Why are we not primarying people for Congress next year who will say the biggest problem we got right now is that we're backing these homicidal maniacs in Ukraine and Israel, and we're going to stop doing that, and everybody else can keep doing all the rest of the crap you're doing, but we're going to stop that, and we're going to save $1 trillion and split it up among us. Nobody's even offering to do that much or organize that much. So I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, I really don't know what's going to happen. Something's going to have to happen, though, because something's going to happen anyway.
Okay, Don, if people are interested in following your work, whereabouts are good places to catch up with you?
Facebook and Twitter and YouTube channel, Don DeBar, DONDEBAR.
Yeah, it's a little bit depressing. I like to try and leave people on a bit of a positive note. And I rather like Catherine Austin Fitz. I don't know if you follow much of her work. From time to time, she comes up with some real gems. And one of her, because I mean, what's happening is this hell they're bringing to the Holy Land. Yes, they're massacring lots and lots of beautiful human beings, but ultimately, this thing is not going to end in glory for them at all. And it seems they don't care. So her phrase to describe it is, "It's a war on God, but God's going to win." So I think we don't know where this is heading, Don, do we?
We don't know, of course, and I'm an atheist, so if God wins, maybe that means nobody wins, but whatever. I agree with her on that. First of all, it is a war on God. If you think of God as all of the things that are good in human beings and the potential that we have, Because if you believe in God, I assume you believe that that's our purpose in the first place. And you know, to do good and to do well and to help each other do that. So I think that you know, I hope that that's exactly where we're headed. I don't see the, you know, the what is to be done thing is still formulating. I just don't see what it is, but I have no doubt it will present at some point. And look, we're either going to fix this or we're going to die trying. I hope at least if we die, though, that we die trying.
Well, we may not be there to see it, but the Holy Real Estate seems to be what they're after. And, you know, actually turning that into some sort of fiery pit of hell. There's something I think hardwired into humanity that is just simply not going to let this pass. Well, I suppose I'm saying in a nutshell is it's they're kind of on a hiding to nothing. So they have no vision. All they have is a vision of their own power and what they want to extinguish. So that's no vision.
That's right. That leads nowhere. That leads absolutely nowhere. And sooner or later, they're going to get there.
All right, Don. That's a nice place to leave it. Thanks ever so much for joining us.
You too, brother. Thanks, Tony. Right, be well.
Cheers.